Lecture 27, India and Indians in the World.
Throughout human history, diverse people have been migrating in and out of the Indian subcontinent. Most studies of Indian history, appropriately enough, concentrate on India itself. They often include discussions of interactions that took place within India between incoming people and cultures and those already present there. But we should also consider the long history of how Indian people and cultures extended into the wider world beyond the subcontinent, both eastward and westward, by land and by sea. In this lecture, we'll start with a brief look at the pre-colonial period, highlighting a few illustrative examples of India's significant effects on other parts of Asia. Then we'll turn to the growing movement of ever larger numbers and types of Indians across the globe, especially from the beginning of the colonial period up to the early 20th century. Later lectures will return to this theme to discuss South Asia's globalization and diaspora into the 21st century. You'll recall that the earliest human migrations from Africa spread into India about 60 to 70,000 years ago. These initial migrations eastward then continued as humans extended from India into Southeast and East Asia. Indeed, the movements of peoples and cultures from India to the East have continued with ebbs and flows ever since. By 3,000 years ago, people living along the shores of the Indian Ocean began to build boats that could brave the sea. Relatively soon afterwards, Indian Ocean mariners discovered the predictable monsoon winds that made longer, more reliable voyages from land possible. To the west, dhows and other types of sailing vessels moved people and cargoes extensively among East Africa, Arabia, Iran, and India. To the east, monsoon-powered ships linked India with coastal Southeast Asia and China. So India has historically been the overlapping center between these major sea trading networks. We can see evidence of these exchanges in the biological and cultural heritage of various communities throughout the Indian Ocean region. For example, there are many Indian merchants who over the centuries settled up and down the East African coast, establishing communities in Zanzibar and many other trading ports there. Additionally, there are clearly East African descended groups that have long been living within India, most notably the Sindhi community in today's Gujarat and Maharashtra coastal regions. Even today, their appearance, music, religion, and language, as well as their DNA, all preserve part of their East African origins. Looking east, cultural exchanges have also flourished since ancient times. For instance, Hindu and Buddhist religious movements that started in India inspired massive monuments and vital traditions within local societies and kingdoms throughout Southeast Asia. Indonesia still boasts its shadow puppets that enact the 4th century Indian Hindu epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. On Java, there is the vast 9th century Buddhist temple complex at Borobudur. Bali, an island east of Java, that was Buddhist and then became Hindu. It remains predominantly Hindu today. Similarly, the famous 12th century Angkor Wat temple complex in Cambodia boasts Indian iconography and architecture, as do temples elsewhere in Southeast Asia. One of the early highlights of such Indian extensions eastward came under the South Indian Chola dynasty of the 9th to 13th centuries. Chola kings expanded their domain from their regional base on the Southeast Indian coast. They made major military conquests in neighboring Sri Lanka. Chola naval expeditions also triumphed in the Maldive Islands to the southwest and then east into Sumatra in 1025. Cambodian kings recognized the political and cultural authority of this Chola dynasty and also its wealth by sending diplomatic and trade missions to that court during the early 11th century. Remember also that Muslim merchants, holy men, and conquerors from Arabia reached Western India in the 8th century, soon after the emergence of Islam. But then Indian Muslims carried the message of the Prophet Muhammad with them as they traded, preached, and ruled throughout coastal Southeast Asia. They converted many local people to Islam, making Indonesia the largest Muslim country in the world today. The extensions of Islam from India also led to substantial numbers of Thai, Malaysians, and Filipinos converting to Islam. Many of today's domestic practices in these various Southeast Asian Muslim communities reveal customs from India. When we consider the passes through the mountains in India's northwest, we find many different groups emigrating and immigrating during much of human history. For example, small groups of Indian merchants, philosophers, mercenaries, and their wives went along to Greece and Egypt with the retreating armies of Alexander the Great in the 4th century BCE. These Indians began occasionally to appear in Mediterranean society from that period and are recorded in Greek historical accounts. Many more Indians also moved west out of India over subsequent centuries. For instance, monks and merchants carried the teachings of Gautama Buddha from India into Afghanistan from the 3rd century BC onward. From there, a few Indian Buddhist monks went along trade routes into China. Some Chinese histories respectfully mention these Indian teachers from the Buddha's homeland. Other types of Indians also migrated westward. For instance, the nomadic Roma people, popularly known as gypsies, migrated from northwest India around the 5th century. We can trace their migrations from India westward through their DNA and also their Romani language, which derived from Punjabi, an Indian language. Various Roma families specialized in particular occupations like tinsmithing and small-scale trading. These Roma roamed over Iran and Armenia. Then one branch spread across North Africa. Another branch migrated into Eastern Europe. They circulated there for 2 or 3 centuries before persecutions and enslavement produced later periods of emigration for some Roma groups west across Europe to the Atlantic coast. The Roma now number 11 million people in Europe alone, mostly in Romania and Bulgaria. Most Roma eventually converted to either Islam or Christianity. But many of these Indian-descended people retain their distinct Roma cultural identity and their traditional migratory role outside of the mainstream of settled societies. Starting in 1498, however, the arrival of European ships that sailed around the southern tip of Africa really began to integrate Indians into a truly global system. This globalization eventually encompassed Europe, Africa, and the Americas, as well as Asia. Not only did Indian products increasingly grow worldwide on European ships, Indian men and women of all social classes did as well. But we should keep in mind that Indians were not always in charge of their own passage overseas. Until the late 20th century, Indians going into the Atlantic world, to Europe and the Americas, almost all had to travel on European-owned ships, usually British. Aboard, they mostly worked for Europeans as seamen, servants, or other kinds of laborers, or paid their way as passengers. So they largely had to adapt to European customs and laws. But many of these early Indian travelers and settlers in Europe, Africa, and the Americas were creative entrepreneurs who were able to succeed even under such adverse circumstances. From the very early 16th century onward, some of the Portuguese ships returning from India around the tip of South Africa brought a few Indians back to Europe. Many were Indians who had converted to Roman Catholicism and served the church, the king, or elite Portuguese families. Such servants were rare curiosities in Portugal, representing the exotic and having valuable knowledge about the Orient. Since they were so costly to bring to Europe on the long and dangerous trip, they added prestige to their aristocratic employers. these Indians also explored Portugal for themselves. When they returned to India, as most of them did eventually, they carried with them their personal impressions and memories of their experiences. They recounted these to their Indian family and friends. So when the next generations went to Europe, they could be even more successful there. From the early 17th century onward, Northern Europeans, particularly the English East India Company, sent larger and more frequent ships to India than had the Portuguese. This greatly increased the flow of many different types of Indian men and women going to Europe, especially to Britain and back. The largest number of Indians who reached Europe during the next three centuries were seamen and servants. During the age of sail, the long sea voyage from Europe around Africa to India was often deadly. During the 17th century, about half of the ships that left England for India never returned home, being sunk by storm or shipwrecked on uncharted shores. Those European vessels that did reach India often faced severe maritime labor shortages. In the Indian Ocean, large numbers of European sailors died from disease or violence, or they deserted to seek their individual fortunes ashore. To replace them, European ship captains hired growing numbers of Indian seamen known as Lascars. During the 17th and 18th centuries, these Lascars customarily received higher wages than did European sailors. So desperate were the European ship captains for replacement manpower for the voyage back to Europe. By the first decade of the 19th century, more than 1,000 Lascars arrived every year in England alone. By the 1850s, that had grown to several thousand Lascars annually disembarking in London's Docklands. Most Lascars only remained in England for a few months until they sailed back to India again. But hundreds settled in cities and villages across Britain, sometimes for a few years, many for the rest of their lives. Most of those that stayed found employment, especially as dock workers, street entertainers, and itinerant vendors. Some ran lodging houses for other Indian visitors in East London's Oriental Quarter, so-called since so many Indians and other Asians lived there. Marriages between Indian Lascars and British working-class women appears to have been fairly common, with their children staying on even when their fathers returned to India. After steamships replaced sailing vessels from the mid-19th century onward, the status of these Lascars changed. British maritime labor unions and government regulations restricted the employment of Indian seamen and lowered the wages they received relative to European sailors. Many Indians no longer sailed as skilled seamen, but as stokers shoveling coal in the sweltering engine room, or as servants for passengers and crew. Another growing class of Indians who went to Britain temporarily or permanently were thousands of male and female servants. Indian servants who went to Britain were not slaves, but rather working-class people who agreed to go, most often either for the money or for the experience. Most servants eventually left Britain, often working for Britons on the voyage back to India. A substantial number of them made multiple trips to Europe over their lifetimes. So they knew what to expect there. About half were women. Many worked as ayahs or nursemaids, looking after the children of the European employers. From the 17th until the early 19th century, Indian servants were quite expensive to bring to Britain, so they added much rare exotic prestige to their employer's household. Thereafter, steamships and changing British government regulations made Indian servants more common and therefore less valued. As British colonialism expanded from the mid-18th century onward, increasing numbers of the Indian wives, mistresses, or children of Europeans went back to Europe with them. Many of these Indian wives converted to Christianity, either in India or after they emigrated. In Europe, they usually dressed as European women of their husband's social class customarily would do. Hence, they soon merged into European society. After a generation or two, their British descendants often did not even know about their Indian ancestors. From about 1600 onward, we have increasing, extensive historical evidence about these Indian immigrants. They're listed in Anglican parish records when they married or had children baptized. Judicial court documents officially record their testimonies as accused criminals or else as plaintiffs who accused others of crimes against them. They occasionally show up in diaries and books by Britons who employed them or encountered them. They even appear in numerous British works of art, painted or sketched from life. Numerous Indian servants advertise for employment in British newspapers. Those working-class Indians who returned to India brought with them extensive knowledge of life in Europe. They must have passed this on orally, but very few of them wrote it down. But from the mid-18th century onward, some well-educated Indian visitors and settlers in Europe began writing about their experiences there. Some authors wrote in Persian or Urdu so that other Indians could read about their discoveries and adventures in Europe. For example, Mirza Itasamuddin went to England in 1766 as a co-leader of a diplomatic mission from the Mughal Emperor to King George III. While his diplomacy did not add much, he learned a great deal about British politics and life during his 2 years there. He also visited France. After his return to India, he reported to the Mughal Emperor on how to lobby the British. He also wrote a book in Persian, Shigraf Nama-e Vilayat, Wonder Book of Europe, to inform his friends at home about life there. This book was later translated into English and published. In addition to Mughal emperors, other Indian rulers also sent embassies to London. By the 1850s, there had been 30 of these Indian diplomatic missions, some with hundreds of Indians in them, mostly servants supporting the ambassador. Several of these ambassadors or their attendants wrote down book-length accounts of their political and personal experiences there. In writing for their fellow elite male Indian readers, many of these visitors repeatedly commented about the relatively free social mixing with British women of their own social class. This was a level of socializing that they would never have permitted between their own womenfolk and European male visitors in India. These accounts by early Indian visitors also uniformly remarked at how uninformed and parochial the British public were at that time. These Indian authors gave examples of how crowds of mystified but well-disposed Britons gathered around them whenever they appeared in public wearing Indian clothing. Some of these authors enjoyed their exotic celebrity status. From the late 18th century onward, more diverse people from India began writing and publishing books in English intended to represent themselves and their culture well to British readers. The first to do so was Amin Joseph Amin. He wrote his autobiography and published it in London in 1792 as The Life and Adventures of Joseph Amin, an Armenian. He was an Armenian Christian born in 1726 who had been raised in Calcutta. He worked his way to London in 1751 as a sailor, but he was not the usual type of Lascar since he was a rich merchant's son and was literate. After various adventures, he went to the English Military Academy at Woolwich and became a gentleman officer. He fought in Europe against the French as part of the English and then the allied Prussian armies. He then battled in Armenia for liberation from the Russian and Ottoman empires. After he returned to Calcutta, he retired and wrote about his life. His evocative autobiography is particularly revealing about life in England, India, and across Asia. Then there is the entrepreneurial Sheikh Din Muhammad. Born in 1759 in Bihar province, he lived from age 11 onward as a camp follower and then a sepoy in the English East India Company's Bengal Army. He rose to officer rank during campaigning and battling across North India. Then at age 25, he emigrated to Cork, Ireland, where he was further educated in English. He also eloped with a young Anglo-Irish woman, Jane Daly, and had several children, all raised Anglican Christians. In 1794, he composed and published his autobiography in English, which he called The Travels of Din Muhammad, written by himself. In a series of letters to a fictional friend, he recounted his life and Indian culture to his Irish and British readers. Then, in his 40s, Dean Muhammad emigrated once again, taking his family to London. There, he worked as a massage therapist before opening his own Indian restaurant in 1810. This was London's first Indian restaurant run by an Indian. He called this the Hindustani Coffee House, but its patrons knew it as the Hookah Club, since they could smoke flavored Indian tobacco and have fine, authentic Indian cuisine there. It received excellent restaurant reviews, but alas, it went bankrupt a couple of years later. Dean Muhammad then reinvented himself once again. He used his greatest resource, his identity as an Indian, to create a new career. He moved to the English coastal resort of Brighton. There he made his fame as a bathhouse keeper and a surgeon practicing what he called Indian-style medicine. He publicized his much famous authentic Indian medical practice in a series of later biographical works published in various versions from 1820 to 1838. He rose to be a fashionable medical practitioner, massaging British kings and European aristocrats. The fame and small fortune that he struggled to accumulate show how he combined his exotic Indian identity with the latest in popular Western-style medical fashions. Dean Muhammad's descendants still live as part of English society. Especially from the 19th century onward, growing numbers of Indians circulated throughout the British Empire, from the Caribbean to the Pacific Ocean, and almost everywhere in between. These Indians emigrated overseas with various degrees of willingness or coercion. There was a small trade in Indian slaves until the early 19th century, when the British outlawed the slave trade internationally. Thereafter, the British used Indian prisoners as workers in many of its colonies. The largest number of Indians, about 30 million men and women, went overseas as manual laborers under the indentured labor system. The name indenture arose since it originally had two parts and a ragged edge resembling teeth when the parts were separated. This contract agreement gave the worker a cash advance and provided sea passage to where he or she would work. The indentured laborer had to work at low wages to repay the advance, usually for 5 or 7 years. The original indentured laborers were actually Europeans during the 17th and early 18th centuries. Indeed, about two-thirds of the Irish, English, Scots, French, and German immigrants to North America by the end of the 18th century went as indentured laborers. Europeans continued to emigrate by indenture until the early 19th century, when the system largely ended for Europeans. But with the end of the European indentured labor, and also in 1833, the British legal ending of intercontinental slave trade, this created a demand for new sources of large numbers of cheap workers. Such manual laborers were especially needed by European-owned sugar plantations in Sri Lanka, Burma, Malaya, Fiji, the Caribbean, Mauritius, and Reunion Islands, and also in South and East Africa. Europeans and freed African slaves generally refused such poorly paid and dangerous employment, as did the local population. However, periodic famines and political upheavals, including from El Niño and India's 1857 uprising, drove many Indians and other Asians to emigrate as free or indentured labor. Labor recruiters, both Europeans and Asians, convinced such impoverished Indian people to sign indenture. Many intended to be temporary sojourners, emigrating to make their fortunes, but then returning home to enjoy it. Indeed, most eventually returned migrated back to India, although few returned rich. Specific regions of India proved catchments for indentured recruitment. These were some of the poorest regions of India, including rural Bihar and the drier agricultural uplands of South India. After they reached the overseas plantations, many indentured laborers worked under conditions as horrific as slavery. The indentures could be bought and sold, and the laborers had to work for whoever owned them. If they broke their indenture, the British classed it as a criminal act, not a civil contract violation. so the police enforced their bondage. Nonetheless, unlike transatlantic slaves, the children of indentured immigrants were legally born free, although their parents might indenture them. As metal-hulled and steam-driven ships replaced wooden sailing vessels from the mid-19th century onward, Asian indentured laborers traveled much faster and further with far lower death rates than had transatlantic slaves. But the recruitment, passage, and immigrant lives of indentured Asians were still often brutal. The British colonial governments occasionally tried to regulate indentured emigration from their territories, as did some of the governments in the receiving British colonies. Most governments legally required that laborers sign the indenture voluntarily, but recruiters sometimes enticed, misled, or forced people into signing. While most Indian indentured immigrants were men, many of those receiving governments and plantations preferred families in order to create more stable worker communities. Immigrants who completed their indenture legally had the option of return passage home, but many chose to stay on as free settlers. About two-thirds of Indian indentured laborers in the Caribbean, for example, remained there. Of the rest who returned to India, about a third again immigrated to the Caribbean, either by signing new indentures or as free workers. Today, there are about 24 million people of Indian descent living overseas. In some former colonies, like British Guiana and Fiji, the Indian population rose to a majority or plurality by the time of independence. Many Indian soldiers were also ordered overseas. They went to conquer and defend British colonies and interests in Egypt, in East Africa, Afghanistan, in Burma, and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, and in China. When the world wars broke out, the British desperately needed Indian manpower as soldiers and military laborers. Almost 1.7 million Indians fought for or served the British Empire in Europe and the Middle East during World War I, more than 2.5 million in World War II. They came back changed men, unwilling to accept their subordinate place under British colonialism any longer. From mid-19th century onward, growing numbers of ambitious Indian elite families sent their sons to Britain for professional educations like law or medicine, or they went to take the examination that gained them entry into the prestigious Indian civil service. Far fewer Indian women went, even from elite families. Overall, these 19th and early 20th century Indian students generally encountered less strong racial prejudice in Britain than they endured in India. The British Raj in India depended on strong racial separation. However, since there were so many fewer Indians living in Britain, that society felt less threatened. Further, the strong class differences prevailing in Britain meant that elite Indian men stood higher than many working-class British men and women. Various young Indian male students recorded their romances, or at least flirtations, with the daughters or servants of their landladies, or even with their landladies themselves. Mohandas Gandhi, for example, described his tentative romantic experiences with British women in his autobiography. By living in England, these young men and fewer Indian elite women gained a better understanding of their colonial rulers. They studied British liberal movements and humanistic values held by many Britons. These Indian students and visitors learned firsthand about parliamentary government and representative democracy. Some who lived there long enough could vote in British elections. A few, starting in 1841, were elected to the British Parliament by English constituencies. A range of movements for socialism or progressive Christianity were attractive to British youth, and many of these movements welcomed Indian supporters and members. Middle and upper class Indian men and women also saw how European imperialism affected not just their home colony, but other non-white colonies around the world. These young Indians also learned from strong European critics of British imperialism like Karl Marx. All this made them aware of their own humanity and rights as citizens, which contrasted with their position in British colonies as oppressed racial inferiors. Therefore, many of the early Indian and African anti-colonial nationalists actually studied in Britain. For example, at age 16, Jawaharlal Nehru, later India's first and longest serving prime minister, went to Harrow, an elite English private school. Nehru went on to take a bachelor's degree in natural science from Cambridge University and qualified for the law in London. Indeed, a large number of the leading Indian and Pakistani nationalists had their advanced education and political awakening in Britain. In the next lecture, we'll discuss Mohandas Gandhi, who went to London to qualify as a barrister or a British elite lawyer, and then practiced law in South Africa, gradually becoming a globally famous political and moral leader.